Today's show is brought to you by BCB Group. You're going to be hearing more about them later on in the show. But for now, let's get into today's conversation. I am so excited for my next guest, Roger Lowenstein, financial journalist, author of so many books, which I've read all but one. And you were out with a new book about the Civil War. Roger, thank you so much for coming on.
Jack, a pleasure to talk to you.
So, Roger, in your latest book, you talk about the Civil War, and that was a really pivotal moment, not just for the country in terms of political issues, but it really was a turning point in terms of finance. I learned that from reading the book. I got a lot of details I want to go into. Just in what ways was it a pivotal moment, and what inspired you to write the book? I believe your last book, which I really enjoyed, was about the Federal Reserve. What inspired you to go half a century back earlier?
Well, that's true. I'm going the wrong way chronologically, but it was actually the last book that inspired me. The last book was about the creation of the Federal Reserve, which happened in the first decade or two of the 20th century. In researching that book, I was curious about the system that the Fed replaced, and sort of surprised to find out that that had been devised during the Civil War amidst all the fighting and everything else was going on. And the more I looked into it, the more I discovered that they'd done a whole lot of financial and other innovation during the Civil War, which I don't think most people realize. Our view of the Civil War is obscured by the very important events militarily and emancipation. Just to sort of set the stage, the biggest thing that happened besides that was that we really had no government going into 1860. The federal government had a post office. It had some customs offices at the ports that collected duties, and that was kind of it. And the Lincoln government built this whole edifice of the federal government that, the beginnings that we have today, in particular financially. We had no national currency. We had no tax system. The federal government had no influence over the economy. All that changed in very dramatic ways in the Civil War, in ways that endure to today. So that's what inspired me.
Yeah, it witnessed the birth of the dollar, the greenback. I think to really get the difference and just how revolutionary the Civil War was in terms of finance, Roger, could you paint a picture of what the financial system looked like before the Civil War? It looked nothing like it was today.
Well, there was no central bank. That had been, we'd had sort of a prototype central bank until the Andrew Jackson era. That was done away with then. That was a quarter of a century earlier. So there were individual banks, so hundreds of them, each chartered by their own states with different rules about what reserves and assets they had. They issued notes, which were IOUs. These weren't officially money, but they circulated. Some notes were good. Some banks were bad. Their notes were bad. Usually, if you took a note from a bank across the street, a merchant would accept it. But if you went to a neighboring state or two states away, it might not be accepted, or it would be accepted at a great discount. So we had this, if you can sort of picture a lot of people in a room, everyone coming from a different country with a different language, trying to speak to each other. That was the antebellum financial system. On top of that, there was no tax basis for the government, except for the tariff on imported goods. And of course, once the Civil War started, trade dropped quite precipitously. So that fell out. So there was no means of financing the threadbare government that we had. We were a primitive country. And strangely, in the sense that by the 1860s, we're industrializing. The economy was well on its way to becoming one of the strongest economies in the world, but financially, we were not. We really had no system.
And in what way did that system of separate state banks, no national money system, no taxation system, in what way was that woefully insufficient to fund the Civil War? And just, can you tell us a little bit about how quickly that became apparent?
Sure. Well, behind these state notes were the state bank notes. Most banks had gold, and you could always go and redeem a note for to the bank for gold, if they had the gold. That was why they got discounted. Nobody really knew. The Eastern banks were generally stronger. So when the war started, the Secretary of the Treasury, a fellow named Salmon Chase, who had been a rival of Lincoln and rather reluctantly accepted the secondary post of a high cabinet official with Lincoln as president, he did what we'd done in other wars. He went to the banks, primarily the banks of Philadelphia, Boston, and New York, and asked to borrow gold to pay for this vastly greater expense of the war. That had always been sufficient in previous wars, which were much smaller, meaning the War of 1812, although there was inflation there, and the Mexican-American War. So he goes to the banks, and the banks say to him, look, why don't we lend you our notes, and we'll keep the gold, and that will continue to be a source of credit for the country. Chase says, no, he's a Jacksonian, he wants their gold. Very reluctantly, they lend him $50 million in gold coin, which is close to all they have. And when they've lent this sum, they have a celebratory dinner, and one of the bankers stands up and says, Mr. Chase, Mr. Secretary, we've lent you the august sum of $50 million in gold. We trust this will be quite enough to fund your war. Well, I have to tell you, Jack, that before the war was over, he was to spend that 60 times over, 60. And that gives you an idea of the challenge. Very soon after that dinner, the bank shut the gold window, and there was no more gold for practical purposes. Chase and Lincoln had to come up with something else to fund the war.
And what did they come up with? And how did they go about deciding whether they wanted to sort of just issue paper money, which had a very bad reputation at the time for being inflationary, versus selling bonds, which the United States didn't have a ton of experience doing either?
So in the immediate instance, they had very little choice. They had one choice, which I'll get to, but the United States credit was not very good. The gold windows of the banks had been shut, which meant the United States also couldn't honor its treasury bills in gold. So England was not going to lend the kind of sums that the United States needed. We had no facility at the time for some sort of mass public borrowing. We didn't have the gold. So paper was it. We had no tax system. So paper was it. Chase and Congress hit on a very interesting scheme, which was instead of just issuing ordinary notes, which would pay interest and be redeemed at a certain date, they decide to issue money, meaning legal tender, just like the bills we have in our wallet today. Nobody thinks about the fact that the dollar bills in our wallet today don't pay interest or aren't redeemable because they're money. They're money. But that's not the way people thought about it in the 19th century. In fact, people were horrified when he proposed to make bills, paper bills, legal tender. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, William Fessenden, the most powerful legislator financially in the country, said, I protest against making anything but gold and silver a legal tender. It offended them morally that only precious metals were really money, but they had no choice. And they thought by making these bills legal tender, it would compel acceptance by merchants. Soldiers would be paid in them, contractors would be paid in them, they could then pass them along, and so on. So that was the first step. But it really wasn't enough because, you know, if you just keep printing paper and paper and paper, we know what happened. And they were aware of this. They'd seen it in the Revolutionary War, where the Continentals became worthless. Same thing in the Revolutionary War, in the French Revolution, and same thing in the Napoleonic Wars in the second decade of that century. So they created something equally revolutionary, which was a system of internal taxes, internal to distinguish them from the tariff, which is the only tax system extant. They created income tax. It was a progressive tax, higher and higher incomes, excise taxes. They assigned assessors to go throughout the country, every business and private residence, followed by collectors. It was quite intrusive. Remember, this is a country that had, and I think it's fair to say still has, a reputation for extreme antipathy to taxes. Antipathy to taxes is why the revolution happened. They were against Britain, if you remember that tea dumped in the harbor. And Americans still felt this way. But the Lincoln government recognized, I think really to its credit, that if there weren't some basis behind the government, the paper that it issued would just become paper and would drastically inflate. And that led it to this tax basis, which really worked. Gave it an ability to do the third thing, which you touched on, which is to borrow. And borrow, because it had a revenue stream behind it, the government was suddenly considered more creditworthy. And after they hired Jay Cook to be their agent, they went throughout the country. The banks were tapped out, but the people weren't. And they actually borrowed billions of dollars over the next 2 or 3 years of the war. And this really made a seminal difference in the financing of the war, in the prosperity of the North, the viability of its currency. They did everything the South didn't do and wouldn't do. And it really had a great effect on the outcome of the war.
In your book, Roger, and I'll just put this on screen, you've got two charts, one about the Southern currency, its inflation, its depreciation, and then compared to the Northern dollar, the greenback. And the Southern, you can enlighten us with the statistics, but the Southern currency depreciated so much more. And part of that reason you attributed to is the South's inability to tax, as well as relying on short-term notes and unable to secure that long-term financing. So, you know, if today you think of, let's say, a treasury yield curve, there's a 3 month on one end and then the 30-year on the other end. The South was really going after that money market, the short end. I think you have a statistic about just how much was short-term paper. And with the long, was the North was able to secure longer-term bonds, 7-year notes, 20-year bonds. Can you tell us a little bit about how the North was able to secure that financing as well? You mentioned Jay Cook, who might be my favorite character in the book.
Well, Jay Cook was certainly morally ambiguous. He considered himself a great patriot. He was his own greatest publicist. He compared his own feats to those of Napoleon, actually said in his memoirs he believed he'd been God's hand, the instrument of God's will to come down and save the North. I should, before people get too carried away with Jay Cook, I should tell you that after the war, he loaded up too much on railroad bonds. His firm failed dramatically and cast the country into a depression that lasted 7 years. But Jay Cook was certainly the man of the hour in the Civil War. And he recognized that the Northern people could be an unseen army in the war. And the idea that I think we became familiar with in World War I and World War II, that the people on the home front can do their bit while the soldiers are fighting and many of them dying. That really began with Jay Cook. He recognized the hidden strength in the Northern people. He appealed to their greed or to their desire to make a profit, assuring them that the strength of the Union economy stood behind these bonds. He also appealed to their patriotism very cleverly. He would publicize the investments of one town against a neighboring town so there'd be competitions and so on, and much like charity drives and so on today. He resorted to every psychological trick. He also suborned more or less newspapers. He was a big advertiser, and he basically told them if they didn't print favorable articles on these, many of which he wrote himself, on these sales, he'd pull his advertising. So he stopped at nothing. He was very effective and very instrumental. You talked about long-term and short-term. I said in the book that the North and South, and really any government, had three choices. One was to tax. Another was to borrow, and the other was to print money. Now, in a sense, printing money, printing notes, and borrowing are the same. You give a soldier a note, and that soldier, in effect, is your creditor. But they don't really act the same way. If you borrow long term, if you sell somebody a bond for 5 years, or 10 years, or 20 years, the bond is stashed in a lockbox or someplace in a vault. It doesn't circulate, and there's no inflationary effect, therefore, and you're secured long-term financing. If you just print money, notes that circulate, people take them to the store, the merchant takes them, they keep circulating around and around. The effect is altogether inflationary. And whenever they're redeemed, because these are short-term notes, you're always having to cycle out more notes to replace them. And just as every government for these reasons would usually rather secure long-term financing, the people who would be their creditors are not so sure, because after all, if you take a long-term bond, you have to know that the credit will be good. And governments were not considered good credit risks in that era. So certainly not. England was considered a good credit risk because the strength of the Bank of England, but the United States wasn't, and not at all. But going into the war, our interest rate had gone up to 12%, pretty much a banana republic rate. In fact, Chase was turning down offers at 20% and 30%. That was he accepted the ones at 12%, which is exorbitantly high. But just to say, there were plenty of people who weren't willing to lend except at really double digit rates. The Confederacy had an even worse problem because who knew Confederacy was new and who knew if it would be around. So they both faced the challenge of borrowing at longer term rates and therefore borrowing at in a way that wouldn't be inflationary. And as I said, I think that the tax bases of the North really provided an anchor to convince creditors that its credit would be good. The South made several mistakes. They had less industry, so that was just a drawback that they were stuck with. When I say less industry, they had less liquid wealth. It was pretty hard to sell. A lot of their wealth was in land. There was declining demand for Southern land, and a lot of their wealth is in slaves. The South did have wealth. They were just reluctant to tax it. They had this anti-federalist or anti-federal ideology. They didn't want a strong federal government. When they first approved a very modest tax, they insisted that collection be left to their states, and the states just refused to collect it. Their attitude was, look, we seceded because we didn't want to be beholden to Washington, and they didn't much like being beholden to Richmond anymore. In fact, this tension persisted throughout. The more Jefferson Davis said, hey guys, we got to come together, they would say, no, that's not what we joined the Confederacy for. And this financially really restrained them. The taxes that they did pass until the very end didn't include land and slaves, where the bulk of their money was, the bulk of their wealth was. They also made an incredible mistake due to a delusion on cotton. In the beginning of the war, it was proposed by Judah Benjamin, the Attorney General of the Confederacy, that they ship their cotton, all the available cotton they had at the time, to England, where it could be sold off as needed to finance the war. And the South had this delusion that just the fact that they had this cotton cartel, they supplied 3/4 of the world's cotton. Cotton was the energy today. We've seen how dependent Europe is on Russia's oil. Well, that was Southern cotton then. They were famous for saying cotton is king. Southern senator famously said, no hand dares make war upon us because of cotton. So they refused this idea to ship cotton to England. They didn't believe that there would be a war. Even when the war began, the Secretary of War, with a flourish, took out his handkerchief and said, if any blood is shed, I'll wipe it away with his handkerchief, as though it was going to be so minor. They thought that Europe, if the war persisted, would intervene and stop the war because it was so desperate for cotton. This turned out to be a colossal miscalculation. And as the war went on and the Northern blockade against the South tightened, remember at the beginning of the war, the sea lanes were open, so they had the opportunity to ship cotton. As the war went on, their source of hard currency diminished. So all these things combined to deprive the South of a hard basis for its currency. They had one opportunity to sell bonds, to monetize their cotton later in the war, which I can talk about if you want. That was another blown opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. So, Roger, before reading your book, I had a vague sense that the South, to put it lightly, had a lot of economic problems. I knew that way more steel was produced in the North. The South was not a diversified economy, to say the least. But reading your book, it was only until reading your book I realized just how much of disaster in terms of economically it was. I mean, you had something like 10,000% inflation over the course of the war, and there was no way for the South to finance it. I'm almost astonished that the South lasted as long as it did. Do you ever wonder that? And do you have any explanation as to how the South was able to persist?
Yes. I mean, just to put some flesh on those figures, a barrel of flour, obviously an essential item, was $5.50 before the war. 2 years into the war, it was up to $38. That's seven times. by the following year, it was $220. And by the end of the war, it was $1,000. So do the math. There were, when the South, in fact, you mentioned the lack of industry, printing notes, the printing press became one of their main industries. Midway through the war, the South was militarily split in half along the Mississippi River. They actually shipped a printing press to the Western arm of the Confederacy, you know, around the Gulf of Mexico, so that they could continue to print notes on the Western side of the Confederacy as well as the South and continue the inflation there as well. The Richmond Papers by 1864 were reporting a common sight of enslaved blacks toting wheelbarrows full of notes, Southern notes. So Lord only knows what you could buy with a wheelbarrow full of notes by that point. But you know, this was really Weimar stuff. By the end of the war, people were advertising in newspapers to purchase things with salted pork, bacon, and cloth. The money was worthless. And, you know, I said that the South had one opportunity to monetize the cotton, which was stuck on their shores. They had a basic problem, which is Europe needed the cotton. They needed what Europe had, which was supplies and particularly ammunition. But they needed the cotton. They needed those supplies now, and Europe couldn't really get hold of much of the cotton until after the war. So a financier approached them and said, we'll do that deal. Give me a very good price for the cotton, and we'll accept the cotton after the war. He was willing to finance them with bonds backed by cotton, which they'd redeem after the war. This is really a dream come true for the South. But strangely, Jefferson Davis was unwilling to take nearly as much as this is a financier called Erlanger. He ran the French arm of a German banking house. Erlanger wanted to give them $25 million. As it turned out, there was enough demand to underwrite $50, $75 million. This is in the middle of the war. It would have been tremendously useful to the South, which was trying to negotiate for a line of steel-plated frigates that would have defended the southern coast and protected their shipping lanes. For some reason I could never figure out, the South refused to take more than $15 million of this. It was a completely blown opportunity. You asked about how do they survive. They were incredibly courageous on the battlefield. They had this grim, cussed determination, I called it. As late as 1864, that's the fourth year of the war, which had been a brutal war by then, they have Grant stuck in the mud in Virginia. Lincoln's being told on all sides that he's going to lose his reelection bid. The McClellan, his rival, is presumably then going to strike a peace with the South. The South is very likely to keep their independence and slavery. So this is in the fourth year of the war. What ran the South down way before it began to finally lose military battles was, in fact, in the economic front. And Southerners said this. I quote a Southern leader saying that the Yankees didn't whip us in the field. We were whipped in the Treasury Department. They began to pine in their newspapers for a Southern Salmon Chase, a Southern version of a Treasury Secretary who could figure out the financing. As the Southern people began to starve, which they did, aside of the home front that I get into in some detail, their soldiers began to desert. The women in Richmond rioted at one point because they were going hungry, and this began to sap their war effort. But I think it really began with their economic collapse. They outpunched their weight, way outpunched their weight to the battlefield.
This episode is brought to you by BCB Group, Europe's leading provider of crypto-friendly business banking for institutions in the crypto space. They also provide trading services, allowing you to trade FX and cryptocurrency quickly and at scale. They specialize in efficient execution of large orders in illiquid markets. So if you are an institution looking to make high volume trades, you need to check out BCB Group, because a great trade idea is worth nothing if you can't execute it. And that is exactly what BCB Group helps you to do. Their mission is to empower the global financial revolution through sustainable and innovative banking. Really glad to have them as a sponsor. So if you want to take control of your digital assets, please check them out at bcbgroup.com/jack. That's bcbgroup.com/jack. Thank you, and let's get back to the show. I know you write how there was a shortage of food, people were starving, so the Confederacy demanded food, and that incentivized farmers and slaveholders of large plantations to not grow food, because if they grow food, it would be requisitioned. So they just grew tobacco, they grew cotton. Roger, one aspect of the South that really hindered them was the naval blockade. I think you write something like only 4% of the cotton in the South was able to be sold. But there were runners. And I think you say that cotton fetched something like 10 cents a pound in the South, but that in the North and especially in Europe, it could fetch up towards of six times that. So it was a very profitable enterprise for people to have runner ships where they would, you know, illegally, they would smuggle the goods and the cotton. Can you tell us about that? And then, you know, are there any parallels to what's going on with Russia's invasion of Ukraine right now?
Sure. But by the way, the South also resorted to price controls, and these were completely evaded, and farmers seeing these price controls just hid there. And then when farmers didn't supply grains at the controlled prices, the Southern government just so-called impressed them, which is to seize them at the controlled prices, and farmers just hid their supplies. And to the great chagrin of Jefferson Davis, they began to circulate greenbacks, the Northern currency themselves. The Southern government made that illegal, but it didn't matter. Southern merchants weren't dumb, and they knew that the Northern currency was worth more. So the blockade arose sort of organically. It worked in two steps. They would get these sleek, low draft runners that could go very fast, generally at night, to evade the Northern Navy from Southern ports, such as Charleston or New Orleans or Wilmington and many other ports, to islands, generally British colonial islands. Once there, they would offload into much larger ships, which could ship larger amounts, and they would fly under the British flag to England. So the bulk of the ship was protected. The United States, of course, couldn't attack British ships. They did intercede once with a British ship, and that caused a great problem for the U.S. diplomatically, and they didn't do it again. So the trick was to get these goods from the mainland to the ports. Because of the danger of being captured, they had to use these small ships, only go when at nighttime and so on. The volumes were necessarily much smaller. So this greatly restricted the volume, the total volumes. Nonetheless, the first year of the war, it's estimated that 9 out of 10 ships got through. It was the Northern Navy. Northern didn't really have a navy, but as the shipyards in the North worked overtime, there were more and more cruisers, and more of these ships were caught. And this acted like a tourniquet on the South, and it really put the lie to their whole economic conception. Before the war, various people had warned the South, Southerners, that they had to industrialize, that their economic system was imbalanced and precarious. They were dependent on the North for basically everything manufactured. Ohio and Alabama, states of roughly equal size, Ohio had 12 times as many railroads. And once the war began, the South could no longer import from the North. They were in trouble, and they had to rely on this stream of Rhett Butler type characters, and most of the blockades were under private charter. So the blockade runners ship what they wanted. They often ship luxury goods such as silk because it didn't take up a lot of room. They were very expensive, so they could get a higher value for less space. This infuriated Jefferson Davis, who wanted things like heavy arms, which of course took up more space, bulkier, heavier ship. The Southern government ultimately chartered some of its own ships, but they just didn't have the wherewithal to do it in size. I think there is a great parallel today. The South had one other venue for its cotton, which was strangely enough the North. Lincoln and Chase were very eager to bring cotton out of the North and sell it themselves for hard currency in Europe. They also wanted to, England and France were suffering a depression because their textile industries had no cotton. They were very afraid that England and France might intervene in the war on the Confederate side and force a peace. This was the South's great hope. This is really what they were fighting for. They weren't going to win militarily. And so Lincoln and Chase hit on this program of authorizing designated traders who applied for permits to go down into the occupied territory, purchase cotton from supposedly loyal Southerners who pledged an oath of loyalty to the North. This is a really absurd policy to rely on these people. Once the money got into the occupied territory, there was no stopping it from seeping into the South and the Confederate coffers. General Sherman was just incensed. He said, "You cannot trade with the people and carry on war against them at the same time." Of course, he was absolutely right. And Grant was also incensed. They passed actually resolutions forbidding traders in their territories from using gold or silver or any kind of authorized currency. They said, if you're authorized, you can use IOUs, which would have stopped the trade, which is what they wanted. The Treasury Department forbade them. However, Sherman said, money is as much contraband in war as powder. A very interesting comment, really, going to what we're talking about. I think this really goes to the situation that NATO, and to some extent the U.S. is in today, carrying on this trade for Russian oil and gas. I think the cotton traders were underwriting a slave system. I think we can say an immoral system, quite freely. And with the growing evidence of atrocities and crimes against humanity in committed by the Russians in Ukraine, there's not just a logistical but also a moral imperative, I think, to stop this trade in Russian oil and gas on the part of NATO and the U.S.
You write that Vladimir Putin is making the same miscalculation that doomed Jefferson Davis's Confederacy a century and a half ago. And you say that the West should learn from the mistake of issuing licenses that Lincoln issued to cotton traders and impose a total ban on Russian energy products. And then you're talking about not just the U.S., which I believe has already done so, but Europe, which now is pondering, they're making some steps to ban coal, but, hundreds of millions of dollars of natural gas is still flowing from Russia into Europe. So just
so is oil. So is oil. Yeah. And I think that will require sacrifices in the U.S. As well, because we can't expect the Europeans to freeze. We're going to have to export more of our resources. I think in the short to medium term, we're going to have to make difficult but probably necessary trade-offs with our own energy policy and drilling. We can't expect the Europeans to endure a depression or humanitarian crisis at home. We may have to drill, more in the short term until there are alternatives. They're based on the pictures we're seeing in the newspapers, war crimes going on as we speak. And I think that was very analogous. I think also that there's an analogy in the beginning of the war. I think Putin counted on the West to be malleable because of its dependence on oil and gas. I think he's discovered that the war is going more toughly, more difficult than expected. I think the South also expected that because cotton was king, so-called, they could have their way. And so I think both Putin and the South were deluded. And I think they were both deluded by living in this sort of isolated echo chamber of a secluded cartel economy. Putin increasingly listening only to his own advisors, thinking that the West and the democracies were weak. The South actually was in its own echo chamber. It actually believed that slavery was a superior system, that there'd be more labor conflict in the North, and that the North had a weaker system and would be dependent on Southern cotton. But proving them wrong, of course, obviously requires that we today stand up to Putin and Russia.
Roger, as you know, a lot of recessions and depressions are preceded by surges in commodity prices, particularly energy and natural gas. I was just looking at a study that found that when oil goes above 3% of global GDP in terms of price consumed, that typically, you know, can cause a recession. You know, I hear that a lot today in 2022, but I don't remember from your book the fact that Britain and France were in a depression because of the cotton, the surge in the price of cotton. So, you know, do you find that history, you know, validates the theory that humongous surges in the price of commodities can cause recessions and even depressions? And if so, you know, how does that affect the calculus of today?
Well, they had a huge supply chain problem. We're very familiar with the biggest industry in the 1850s and 60s were textiles. Textiles was where the Industrial Revolution began. You know, all these red brick mills in New England, those were textile mills in Lancaster, in England, in Manchester, in Lyon, in France. Those are textiles. That was the big industry that really triggered the Industrial Revolution. Suddenly, there's no cotton. So there were hundreds of thousands of mill workers unemployed. There's starvation reported in both England and France. It was a depression in that sense. In the 70s, we had a severe depression or a recession in 73, 74. We had another one in 1980, triggered by the Fed had to act, obviously, very stringently against the inflation of the late 70s, which created the back-to-back inflation recessions of 80 and 82 under Volcker. And again, the price of oil shot up in 1990, the invasion of the American invasion of Kuwait to kick out Iraq, and we had a recession then as well. I'm not going to get into predicting recessions. You know the old line about predicting 9 out of every 3 recessions or something. You know, it's a risk. It's a risk. We've had a very strong recovery, but we've had incredible growth in demand even before the, and I mean monetary demand. I mean stimulus and you know, if you take Larry Summers' word, and I do. I think overstimulus, even before the bad luck, in a sense, of the Ukraine war. And I think, you know, sometimes if a recession comes, it comes. We can't, sometimes there's no avoiding one, and that will set things back in balance. And we may need then further stimulus when that comes, but we'll see. We'll see. It's certainly a risk, but I can't put a number on it or percentage on it.
Yeah, you talked about inflation. If we can roughly put the inflation of the North during the Civil War, and correct me if I'm wrong, maybe in the U.S. 1970s territory, maybe a little bit more, and then the South that you mentioned earlier, maybe a little bit more in the Weimar territory of, you know, 10-20,000% inflation.
So the South was 9,000%, absolutely Weimar territory. Weimar before Weimar. The North, I think the better comparison for me anyway, is to latter wars. It was 80% over the course of the war, which is significant. But wars create demand, excess demand. So you're going to have some inflation. Interestingly, in World War I and the World War II periods, it was also just about 80%. So the fact that they did no worse than in the latter era when there were far more financial tools, far more experience and so on, you know, I think that's That was painful, but given the circumstances, reasonable. What happened in the South obviously was unreasonable financially.
So Roger, the inflation that we see today, you said you believe that the Larry Summer view. Could you describe what you mean by the Larry Summer view? And in particular, you know, is it demand side inflation? Is it supply side inflation? And does the answer to that question tell us whether or not, you know, rate hikes and federal tightening of monetary policy will be effective?
Well, look, we just had a quarter of a point increase in the federal funds rate to, I guess now it's officially between a quarter and a half or something like that. If inflation is 7.9%, that means we've gone from a real interest rate of, help me with the math here, negative 800 basis points to negative 775 or 750. It's absurdly stimulative. This debate, as and this is one of Summers' seminal points, it really can't be overstressed, about whether it's supply or demand. The Federal Reserve can't do anything about supply, you know, in any near term, and maybe not even the long term. They can't get more cars and more computer chips shipped to Los Angeles. They can't. All they can do is affect demand. It's their job to make sure that demand is in rough parity with supply, whatever the supply is. So to say, well, the supply dipped, that's not an answer. That's not an excuse. It's their job to make sure that the demand is adequate and not more than adequate to the supply. When you have demand, when you have inflation now running at 8%, that's, you know, prima facie evidence that demand has way outstripped supply. We're not blaming the Fed for the fact that computer chips aren't arriving at our docks. We're blaming them for people have more money than the available supply of computer chips and other products. And, you know, absent any, by the way, this is also what happened in the 70s. We had the government of Lyndon Johnson trying to fight two wars in Vietnam and the war on poverty, carried over to Nixon. And then that was coupled with the bad luck of the first oil shock in 73 and later the second, the Iran oil shock. So you can't count on good luck. Finances, I said this in the book, is always the art of planning for the worst. It's like building a bridge. You don't build a bridge with just enough steel to carry light trucks, because someday there may be a heavy truck going over it. And to keep saying, we're sure supply chain is going to readjust, this is going to be gone soon. The Fed has, in effect, been planning for the best. And when the best didn't occur, I don't know what basis they thought this, but in any case, you've got to plan for the worst. And since we've sort of gotten a dose or two of bad luck, we've not only had the 5 or 6% inflation that we would have had anyway, but now with the war, we're up to, I think, 7.9, you know, tremendous wage growth, but stimulating inflation that is overlap wage growth and thus taken away the long overdue real gains of workers. So I'd be very surprised if these quarter point increases in the federal funds rate are going to do it. You know, whether or not there's inflation, I'd only say this, that the sooner the bigger increases come, the easier they'll go down, the less likely a recession or other really unpleasant aftermath will be. The longer you wait for the stiff medicine, the more unpalatable I think it'll be.
Mm. And the stiff medicine, some fear that will cause a severe drop in asset prices, and you know, asset prices have been on a tear since 2009. You chronicled the rise of the Federal Reserve. How have you seen its mandate drift? I believe maybe it was in the 60s that it came up with the idea of stable employment and stable inflation, the dual mandate. But then there's sort of a hidden mandate that asset prices shouldn't go down, the Bernanke theory that if asset prices go down, then people will spend less money, firms won't hire, and it will sort of be a daisy chain that will lead to a recession. If it is the case that the only way to curb inflation is to impose a recession, like Volcker did twice in the 1980s, how do you think the Federal Reserve's appetite is? If it, which path is it going to choose?
Yeah. Well, I see what Bernanke's philosophy is more that he didn't want to pop asset bubbles. Because A, he believed, he's a pretty strong believer in the efficient market hypothesis that therefore, forward looking, you couldn't tell what was a bubble. And secondly, interest rates are blunt tools. So we don't want to send the United States economy, to pick an easy example, into a recession just to prick the crypto bubble. Let's say you thought crypto should be $10,000, not $40,000, whatever it is today. Or let's say you thought it should be at zero. You probably wouldn't want to put steel workers out of work for that purpose. But the it wasn't the Fed. Let's go back to the dual mandate, employment and and stable money. It wasn't the Fed that changed that, it was Congress. And I'm completely okay with the dual mandate because after all, if you don't have stable employment, if you have a depression, the money's not gonna be stable either. So they're really consistent. I think the danger is when the natural temptation of central bankers who get their advice from economists and bankers and people who sort of swim in a Wall Street world is to be overly afraid of the effect of an asset crash. And I think, although I don't think it's their job to usually to prick bubbles, nor is it their job to defend asset prices. And I think that's the real risk. And they have a clear congressional mandate to promote long-term maximum employment and stable prices. And they've interpreted stable prices as 2% with 2% inflation. And that's fine because of the stickiness of employment. You know, it's easier, it's hard to lay people off. So there's an argument that economies are more efficient with a little bit of inflation because it's hard to lower prices. That's fine. But when you get to 7%, you're way beyond 7% inflation, 8% inflation. You know, you're no longer in the neighborhood of 2%. And I think they've got to do whatever is necessary to get back down in that neighborhood. And if asset prices crack, that means they were too high and we'll survive. And it's, better to have the Dow from, correct from 30,000 than from 60,000. I mean, it's, we've seen this very often, and we had a severe recession, very painful in the Volcker period. But after that, we went on a tear in the 1980s, both asset prices and the economy. The American economy was really, if you discount the very brief recession of 1990, which was wholly a product of the Iraq War, the economy had 18 years of solid growth. Once Volcker had put it on a sounder footing. So I'd like to see the Fed less the guardian of asset prices and more the guardian of what Congress, which created it, mandated it should be the guardian of.
Mm. Well, we may get to see that. Roger, as we reach a close, I want to ask you, what was your biggest learning from the book, something that you took away from all of your research? I could think of like five, but I want to hear your answer.
I think the humility of President Lincoln is something that particularly in today's, people ask me a lot, because it's a Civil War book, are we going for another Civil War and so on? I'm reminded of when he was a congressman. This is in 1847. He had one term in Washington before, way before he was president, and he proposed an internal improvement. Lincoln felt very strongly about building canals, the Transcontinental Railroad, improving harbors, things to improve trade, particularly for people in the interior of the country, where the transportation system wasn't very good or complete. This is, the Build Back Better of his day, and it was very necessary. Imagine America had Eisenhower not built the national highway system. His government had to do these things, and he believed that a government existed to do things that people couldn't or wouldn't do for themselves. So he proposes this bill for internal improvements, and someone on the other side just eviscerates him. He just attacks him unrelentingly. And when the guy's finished, Lincoln gets up again, doesn't defend himself, doesn't defend his plan. He just says, most things, especially of government policy, aren't all good or all evil. Most are a combination of some good and some evil. And we're just looking for things that have more good than evil in them. I would love to hear people talk about the issues of our day in that vein, acknowledging that people on both sides have a point of view, that there are trade-offs, that there are trade-offs to taxation and equality and just about oil policy, any issue we can think of, instead of the sort of moralism on either side. He was really a remarkable, not just a remarkable leader, but a remarkable person. That would be my first takeaway.
Well, Roger, it's been an absolute pleasure getting the chance to pick your brain. The book is Ways and Means, Lincoln and His Cabinet and the Financing of the Civil War. Roger, thank you so much.
Jack, always a pleasure.